The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
When 28-year-old Aaron Shearhorn approached the doorman at Houston's Club Blur at about 11:45 p.m. on December 10, 2010, he was frantic and panicking. He'd been stabbed, Aaron excitedly screamed as he opened his shirt, exposing the wound. But the doorman wouldn't let him in, allowing Aaron's attacker to catch up. The large man stabbed him again, and Aaron ran, this time into a parking lot next to the club. There, Aaron was stabbed by the man several more times, wounds he'd later die from at an area hospital. About eight folks witnessed this horrific and brutal crime, one of whom later called Crime Stoppers of Houston to report he'd seen Aaron's attacker and had taken down the VIN number of the vehicle he was in. That car belonged to 33-year-old Lydell Grant, who was later arrested on a warrant during a routine traffic stop and charged with Aaron Shearhorn's slaying. Although Lydell's friend provided an alibi that strongly showed the man could not have committed the crime, and no determination could be made regarding the DNA evidence taken from skin cells found underneath Aaron's fingernails, several witnesses positively identified him as the killer. A jury convicted Lydell Grant of the first-degree murder of Aaron Shearhorn on December 6, 2012. He was sentenced to life behind bars. The Innocence Project of Texas picked up the case after Lydell's conviction was upheld upon an appeal in 2014. After further testing of DNA evidence, it was conclusively determined that Lydell did not commit this crime. The DNA under Aaron Shearhorn's fingernails, in fact, belonged to another man named Jermerico Carter. Thankfully, as is not always the case in this state, Lydell Grant was released on bond with the cooperation of Harris County prosecutors and eventually exonerated. He'd spent 10 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Eyewitnesses were sure Lydell killed Aaron, and he was convicted on little more than that. Jermerico Carter later confessed to detectives who traveled to a Bullock County, Georgia jailhouse to interview him. Mistaken identity cases aren't all that uncommon in Texas true crime, but it's not only due to false identifications by eyewitnesses or police. Some victims are also thought to have been mistakenly identified by their killers. This occurs most often, perhaps, as the result of gang violence, but not always. The death of a North Richland Hills woman, by all indications, is an example. On the evening of Sunday, December 9, 2007, retired couple Don and Marianne Wilkinson sat relaxing in their home in the quiet upper-middle-class housing development, Forest Glen North. They were not expecting company, so when their doorbell rang at about 8 p.m., it was perhaps odd, but nevertheless, Marianne got up and answered. When she opened the door, the 67-year-old was sprayed with gunfire. The killing stumped the North Richland Hills police. This elderly couple had no enemies. They lived a quiet and completely normal life. The day after the senseless killing, a woman came to police with a possible explanation. The bullets, she thought, were meant for her. She and her husband were going through a hostile divorce, and he'd made a throat-cutting gesture with his finger, among many other threats, she told detectives. It seemed even more plausible when police found out that not only did the woman live on a cul-de-sac parallel to the Wilkinsons, the houses of similar style and brick, but also the number of her house was the exact number of Marianne and Don's. Though Marianne Wilkinson's case remains unsolved at the time of this recording, the possibility that she was shot to death as the result of a murder-for-hire gone wrong, a case of mistaken identity, is perhaps the most compelling and sensible theory. When two women in Harris County, Texas, were killed within days of each other in October of 2000, a connection or a possible murder due to mistaken identity might have never been theorized had they not shared the same name, Mary Morris. Mary Lou Muncy was born in Houston, Texas on August 16, 1952, to parents John and Mabel. She became Mary Lou Henderson when she married her first husband, with whom she had two children. In 1987, however, the couple divorced after 17 years of marriage. Mary Lou met another divorcee, Jay Morris, through a personal ad. The two had much in common and hit it off pretty quick. Eventually, in 1995, Mary Lou and Jay tied the knot, a second marriage for both. Though the crime rate was on a slow decline in Houston in the mid and late 1990s, the city still had a major problem. Jay and Mary Lou Morris wanted out. In 1998, they moved to Baytown, a considerably smaller city to the east of Houston with considerably less crime. The following year, Mary Lou and Jay moved into a home they had built on a large property, often referred to as a ranch, off Burnett Bay on Baytown's north side. Mary Lou and Jay Morris were an active couple, her particularly. According to her daughter, in fact, her mother acted like she was 20 years old, always going somewhere, always doing something. At 48 years old in 2000, Mary Lou Morris had been working for 15 years as a loan officer at Chase Bank in Spring Valley Village, a small suburban city located on Interstate 10 to Houston's west. The commute to work from home was 32 miles. About an hour drive directly through downtown Houston during rush hour, when its traffic was unavoidable and insufferable. But the drive was for the most part a straight shot. Mary Lou, it's said, never missed a day of work, but she was even more devoted to her family than she was her job. She loved her children and grandchildren. Mary Lou was kind, her daughter said. One of the nicest folks you could ever know. On Thursday, October 12, 2000, Mary Lou had some extra work to do at the office, so to get ahead of it, she decided she'd leave home a little early. Between 5:50 and 6 a.m. that morning, Jay walked Mary Lou to the car as usual. The couple said their goodbyes for the day, and Jay watched as Mary Lou turned from their home. She was headed in the direction of the Speedway gas station and convenience store at Interstate 10 and Thomas Road, where she often filled up the tank before heading into work. It was her go-to gas station because the prices were generally the best around there. Because it was a part of her regular routine, Jay assumed Mary Lou was going to stop for gas before hitting the highway. Nothing at all that morning seemed amiss, but as the hours passed, things took a turn toward the unusual. Jay Morris almost always called and spoke with his wife several times a day, but Thursday, October 12, 2000, was different. At 12 p.m. that day, he began a series of calls trying to get in touch with Mary Lou, all of which went to voicemail. None of the calls were returned. Perhaps, Jay thought, his wife was simply too busy to call back. After all, she'd left for work early to get a jump on some of the extra work she had. In between his many calls, sometime just after 2 p.m., a woman called and asked for Mary Lou. Jay told them she wasn't home and thought little about it, at least for a while. Between 3 and 4 p.m., Jay Morris called Mary Lou's place of employment, Chase Bank in Spring Valley Village. He spoke with a branch manager, and immediately, a sense of dread overcame him when she told the man Mary Lou had never made it in that day. In fact, this supervisor was the woman who'd called the house looking for her about an hour earlier. Something was not right. Not only did the dependable Mary Lou set out for work that morning, Jay knew damn well his wife never missed a day of work without good reason. And this day, there wasn't one. Alongside his stepdaughter Marilyn, Jay began retracing the steps and route Mary Lou would have taken. She'd forgotten her cell phone and charger at the house, the two discovered, so they worried Mary Lou's car broke down or worse, she'd been in an accident. They couldn't find the missing woman anywhere. Because their neighbor was an investigator for the Harris County Sheriff's Office, Jay Morris was able to give a missing persons report that afternoon, but it was too late. At approximately 5 p.m. on October 12, 2000, a man off-roading on a four-wheeler in a tall grass pasture off West Lynchburg Cedar Bayou Road in Baytown made a grisly discovery. When inspecting a smoldering car he'd come upon, the joyrider saw inside a charred body so badly burnt, no distinguishing features remained. He immediately called police. Not long after first responders arrived at the scene, detectives and crime scene investigators from the Harris County Sheriff's Office showed up. From the front grille to the trunk latch, the vehicle was burned evenly. All plastic within the engine, the wiring, the interior, the tires, and even some glass was melted. Inside were human remains that were unidentifiable, some of which had fallen through the frame of the reclined front passenger side seat to the back seat of the vehicle. At the scene, investigators could not determine whether the body was male or female. When they got word a burned car had been found, Mary Lou's husband, Jay, and daughter Marilyn rushed to the scene, but were met by sheriff's deputies well before arriving at the site of the smoldering remnants. Deputies told them they could not be there and asked that they return home and wait for news, should there be any. Later, the burned-out vehicle would be identified as Mary Lou Morris's gray Chevy Lumina. Harris County Sheriff's Office Detective W.D. Lanier commented that they were lucky to find a part of a jaw with intact teeth, as any other possible identifiers had turned to bone fragment or ash. Though it took 3 days, the charred body was finally confirmed to be the vehicle's owner. It was impossible, of course, to determine Mary Lou's cause of death. Where Mary Lou's car and body were found is in the opposite direction of the one she would have taken to go to work. It was about 3.5 miles from her home near Burnett Bay, a spot ironically secluded within the confines of the many surrounding residences and accessible only by using a well-traveled thoroughfare. Whoever drove Mary Lou's car there traveled down West Lynchburg Cedar Bayou Road, which would have been busy, and turned just past John Martin Road, where the traffic turning on and off would also have been significant. This person, presumably Mary's killer, then had to get out of the vehicle, open a gate that led into property owned by the Harris County Drainage District, and drive through grass for about 150 yards, where they parked the Chevy Lumina in an isolated pipeline ditch not visible from the Drainage District road. Since it seemed disposing of the body and evidence by fire at this location could not have been a random decision, And because the spot where Mary Lou's car was set ablaze and burned, likely for hours, could not be seen from the many homes surrounding it, police theorized her killer was quite familiar with the area. The fact that no area residents reported seeing smoke in that area was surprising, though burning domestic wastes and other debris there was legal under certain circumstances, meaning that there were likely folks who witnessed the smoke, but since rural residential burning wasn't necessarily uncommon, they might not have given it a second thought. It was later discovered that a fire truck crew had indeed seen and reported the smoke to their superiors at about 10:20 a.m. that morning. They were told not to worry about it. It was simply someone burning leaves or trash. The determination by the firefighters' superiors, perhaps, reflected the attitude of the folks living nearby. Though evidence might have been saved had they been told to investigate the smoke, certainly a mistake in hindsight, this discovery wasn't all wasted, since the Harris County Sheriff's Office at least had another mark on the timeline. Immediately upon their arrival, a crime scene investigation unit began closely inspecting Mary Lou's Chevy Lumina, what was left of it, and the area surrounding the vehicle. Fire investigators determined quickly that the car was set ablaze intentionally using what they called massive amounts of accelerant. In the area around where the fire had chaotically and unremorsefully burned, trees were singed from trunk to crown. Inside the vehicle, nothing of evidentiary value survived the ravaging flames. There were no fingerprints, no bullets, bullet casings, or any other sign of the weapon that might have been used to murder 48-year-old Mary Lou Morris, and no way to know if she was still alive as the car went up in flames. As is the normal course of action in any murder investigation, the Harris County Sheriff's Office ran an extensive background check on the victim and interviewed those who knew her best, including friends, co-workers, and close relatives. No motive for Mary Lou's murder could be found. All her life, Detective W.D. Lanier said, she was a law-abiding woman who had no enemies. Not a single person interviewed had a neutral word to say about Mary Lou Morris, let alone a negative one. They all loved her. There were absolutely no signs she'd been having an affair, using drugs, was gambling and got behind on a debt, or anything else that would suggest a high-risk lifestyle, a motive to pursue. She was kind to everyone and certainly not living any kind of secret life on the side. Mary Lou seemed incredibly stable in and happy with her life and had even continued to maintain good terms with her ex-husband, Joe. He had nothing negative whatsoever to say about her, and had helped search for her before the family knew her body had been found. The fact that Mary Lou's jewelry remained on her body, though melted until it was virtually unrecognizable, suggested that the motive was not robbery. One piece of jewelry, however, was missing: Mary Lou's wedding ring. Following Mary Lou Morris's funeral, the investigation into her murder took a strange and convoluted turn when a striking similarity, or several similarities, between hers and the death of another woman was discovered. The funeral and burial for Mary Lou Morris took place on Monday, October 16, 2000. After her daughter Marilyn phoned the Harris County Medical Examiner's office, she told them her mother's name, Mary Morris, and asked when she could pick up the jewelry her mother had been wearing. The medical examiner's office told Marilyn that she could retrieve her mother's belongings after the funeral home picks up the body. Her mother was just buried, Marilyn told them, but they replied that the body of Mary Morris was still in the medical examiner's possession. Marilyn and her family had just placed 19 pounds of ash and bone fragment in a grave to be marked with her mother's name, she thought, and the young woman began to panic. Had they undergone funeral services for and buried remains that did not belong to her mother? It seemed like an impossible mistake, one that would be just as impossible to rectify. Finally, someone in the medical examiner's office was able to get to the bottom of the mix-up. They had been given the correct remains. The body that still laid in the morgue was someone else, a woman who was found dead the very morning before Mary Lou Morris was laid to rest, a woman named Mary Teresa Morris. Born in Welch, West Virginia, to parents Rose and Hugh on July 7, 1961, Mary Teresa McGinnis became Mary Teresa Morris when she married Mike Morris in 1983. The following year, the couple gave birth to their only child, a daughter. Mary Teresa's sister Stephanie called her vivacious and very outgoing, a devoted mother with a positive and enthusiastic outlook on life. She lived life to the fullest, Stephanie said, an angel who not only got along with and loved nearly everyone, but who also worked to make sure those around her were happy and laughing. In 1998, Mary Teresa took a job as the medical director for Union Carbide in Houston, Texas, leaving her family and home in West Virginia behind. Union Carbide is one of the oldest and most successful chemical companies in the United States, and produces products that serve markets ranging from household to oil and gas, and virtually everything in between. Mary Teresa was extremely successful, and this job, which had her overseeing several clinics in the company's industrial plants as a head nurse practitioner, was a testament to her abilities and professionalism. In fact, her sister Stephanie insisted that anything a doctor could do, so could Mary Teresa, and she did. She was a hard worker who didn't give doubles and weekend shifts a second thought. Outside of work, she most enjoyed acting in local theater productions. Still, as near perfect as Mary Teresa was thought of professionally, she was certainly not immune from life's less desirable situations and circumstances. Even before moving to Houston, Mary Teresa's marriage to Mike Morris had its ups and downs, as all marriages do. Once they arrived in Texas's most populous city, the marriage became further strained, in large part, it seems, because Mike was unemployed for some time. Of course, being out of work can do a number on the socially sculpted male ego, sometimes leading to feelings of inadequacy and broken self-confidence, which is perhaps why Mike accused Mary Teresa and a coworker of hers of having an affair. Perhaps they were, and perhaps they were not, but when he confronted them, Mike Morris later commented, the two denied it while looking him in the eye, and, he added, he chose to believe them. This situation apparently was the crescendo for the couple's problems, the make-or-break point. Mike and Mary Teresa decided to work through their problems, and by October of 2000, were back to being the very best of friends, Mike said. The marital problems, as is the case with almost every married couple, were complicated, but a difficult period that he and Mary Teresa had overcome, according to both Mike and, years later, the couple's daughter. Again, Mary Teresa Morris was a workhorse, so naturally, she generally had little time off to take care of her errands and chores. On October 15, 2000, she planned to knock out her to-do list for the week, as she did every Sunday. Mary Teresa met her good friend and co-worker Lori at the Union Carbide Clinic to get a flu shot. Workaholic she was, Mary Teresa told Lori she was going to hang around there for a couple hours before finishing up her errands and returning home. She went to the post office, then a grocery store, before finally ending up at the Eckerd Drugstore at West Little York Road and U.S. Highway 290 in Northwest Houston. While at Eckerd, Mary Teresa called Lori. Someone in the drugstore was giving her the creeps, making her very uncomfortable, Mary Teresa told Lori matter-of-factly. She didn't sound scared, Lori later said, just aware. Mary Teresa told her friend she was going to run back to the clinic at Union Carbide, sign out of her computer, and head home. 12 minutes after hanging up with Lori, Mary Teresa made a frantic call to 911. The audio recording has never been released to the press or public, but Harris County Sheriff's Office Detective Wayne Coleman called it blood-chilling and disturbing. The phone call captured an attack against the 39-year-old woman. That evening, after she failed to return home, Mary Teresa's husband, Mike Morris, reported her missing to family, friends, and authorities. The following morning, Monday, October 16, 2000, a wrecker driver came upon a 2000 Dodge Intrepid just north of the 8600 block of West Little York Road in a desolate area not far from the last known location of Mary Teresa Morris, an Eckerd drugstore, though in the opposite direction from where she was thought to have been heading, which was the clinic where she worked. The vehicle was her Union Carbide Company car, and inside was the bloody body of Mary Teresa. The woman had suffered a single gunshot wound to her head. As was the case in the murder of Mary Lou Morris 3 days earlier, Mary Teresa Morris was not wearing her wedding ring. Strange theories developed about the potential connection between the October 12, 2000 murder of Mary Lou Morris and the slaying of Mary Teresa Morris on October 15, 2000, if only for a fleeting investigative moment. The public and media, however, seem to have a much harder time letting go of the possibility of a link. The press often manipulating readers and viewers into thinking the two crimes took place virtually right next door to each other, when in actuality they happened on opposite ends of Harris County, Mary Teresa's in far northwest Houston, and Mary Lou's in Baytown, nearly 37 miles to the east. Next time on Gone Cold, the investigation that ensued, the theories, and the suspects. If you have any information about the murder of Mary Lou Morris or Mary Teresa Morris, please contact the Harris County Sheriff's Office at 713-274-9100 or Crime Stoppers of Houston at 713-222-TIPS. That's 713-222-8477. If you have not already, look for Gone Cold on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter by searching Gone Cold and looking for the Texas logo. If you'd like to support the show and get the episodes ad-free, go to patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. Thanks to all of you who support us there. It's a huge deal to us. If you're not in a position to help Gone Cold financially but would like to in some other way, well, I've got just the thing. Leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes particularly helps Gone Cold's visibility. The more folks who find us and listen, the greater chance someone with information about a case hears the show and comes forward with what they know. Every little bit helps, and we appreciate y'all's support immensely, however you choose to give it. Sources for this episode can be found in the episode's show notes. Thanks for listening, y'all.